All right, our next presentation for the day, our last sort of research presentation for the day in general, it's Michael Hopper. He was he's first off not only the sort of co-chair of the Business of Baseball baseball Committee, he's also won the Doug Pappas Award for Best Presentation at a Sabre Convention, nice to do, and even more impressively, won the Henry Chadwick Award for Lifetime Contribution to Baseball Research, really nice. Also, as you see with a t-shirt, a Cubs fan, so without further ado, here he is, take it away.
Thank you so much, and wearing Cubs and White Sox ties in with Cap Anson, who played for the White Stockings, and never the Cubs. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Cap Anson today, not the typical stuff about, you know, his racist behavior, his ability to keep blacks out of baseball, but rather the rather sad way that his career ended in Chicago. So Cap Anson during his lifetime was described as the most conspicuous ball player in the nation by the Chicago Tribune, and the great sports writer Hugh Fullerton called him the greatest man in the history of baseball. And that quote goes on further. Hugh Fullerton made this comment in 1921 when Babe Ruth was having a rather spectacular start to a career that only Shohei Ohtani has duplicated since. So during Cap Anson's career and his lifetime, he was regarded as perhaps one of the greatest players of his time. So just to kind of quickly summarize his life here, he was born in what was then Marshall, Iowa, and is now called Marshalltown, Iowa, in 1852. At age 15, he earned a spot on the town team with his father and his brother. And in 1870, his career really began when they played an exhibition game against Rockford, a professional team that came down and had a young pitcher named Albert Spaulding on the team. And they came to Marshalltown and played a game. And Spaulding was so impressed by not just Cap Anson, but by his dad and his brother, that he offered all three of them contracts to play with Rockford. And his father turned down that contract offer on behalf of all three of them, saying that his sons were going to attend Notre Dame. Adrian did attend Notre Dame, the high school, the prep school, for one semester, and then unbeknownst to his parents, he signed a contract to play with Rockford for the princely sum of $66.66 a month. He did very well that year. 1871, he played for Rockford, hit .325, led the league with doubles. The team folded at the end of the year. By this time, Spaulding was already gone. He was gone. He was in Boston by now. And so after that season, Philadelphia picked up Anson's contract, and he finished out the NA's lifetime with the Philadelphia team. And then very famously, in the summer of 1875 and the fall of 1875, William Hulbert came along and poached five of the players from other teams, Eastern teams in Boston and Philadelphia, to come back west to play for Chicago. So most famously, he signed Al Spaulding for $2,000 and 30% of the team's net profits. Ross Barnes got $2,000 and 25% of the team's net profits. And then Anson got $2,000 and a $200 advance. And Anson was actually talked out of going back to Chicago by his wife, Virginia. She was a native Philadelphian, and she said, "We're not moving to Chicago." So Anson contacted Hulbert and said he was returning the $200 and staying in Philadelphia. And Hulbert said, "Well, you signed a contract, and a gentleman always goes by his word." And so Anson said, "Okay, I'll come for just this 1 year." He never left Chicago. So when he did come to Chicago, they started out quite well. They won the first pennant in 1876. He was in the top five in just about every important hitting category. Spaulding actually retired from playing at the end of the year. He did appear for a few more innings the next year, but he kept on managing for 1 year, and then he moved into the club secretary position. And ultimately, he would become club president. And this is going to be the kind of the link that Anson saw as his way of moving up in baseball, but ultimately would prove to be his downfall. As a baseball player, Cap Anson was marvelous. He played with the Chicago White Stockings from 1876 to 1897, won four batting titles, eight RBI titles. He batted .331. His career hits wavered somewhere between about 2950 and 3400, depending on who's counting and what year it's counted. But he was the exclusive member of the 3000 hit club until 1914. And then lost that distinction in, I think it was 1989, and then it came back again later on. He managed the team from 1879 to 1897, winning five pennants, which is the 11th most all time. And in fact, with players or with managers who've managed at least 1,000 games, he has the 8th highest winning percentage in the history of baseball. 579 winning percentage overall. So he was a fantastic player, a great captain of men, and a very good manager. The connection with Spalding is actually a long one. So in 1870, he was discovered by Al Spalding when Spalding came to town, recruited him to come to Rockford. By the time he actually joins the Rockford team, Spalding's in Boston. In 1874, Spalding asks him to come along as part of the athletics team and the Red Stockings and when they went to England, and they played a series of games over in England. In 1875, he recruited Anson to come to Chicago. He was one of the five players that Spalding, or four players that Spalding recruited after he signed with the White Stockings. In 1888, he took him along on the World Tour, which made such an impression on Cap Anson that if you read his biography, about half of it is like reading his diary of that trip. He really was impressed by going around the world, by being with Al Spalding. And if you read some of the letters he wrote, some of the articles, it seems that Cap Anson saw the relationship with Spalding as more symbiotic than Al Spalding did. And we'll get to that in just a minute. And then in 1889, Al Spalding did something that wouldn't happen again until the free agency era. He signed Anson to a 10-year contract. Now, this is stunning back then because almost nobody had more than a one-year contract. But even today, a 10-year contract is rare. You know, we see them now as teams sign these contracts so they can pay the money out over a longer period of time. I don't think anybody really thinks Carlos Correa is going to be playing shortstop for the Twins when he's 44 years old. But we sign them to these long-term contracts. Well, this is Cap Anson was the first one to ever have a double-digit contract. Unfortunately for him, it didn't work out that way. Okay? So in 1879, he's named manager of the team, as I said before, and does quite a good job. And in 1880, he becomes a part owner of the team. He buys 5 shares of stock, which is 5% of the team at the time, from Edwin Dexter, who had been a friend of Al Spalding's. He was in the sporting goods business, and he wanted to get out of owning the team. So he sold the shares, and depending on who you ask, either the club bought the shares and gifted them to Anson, the club bought the shares and then gave them to Anson instead of his contract, which called for a share of the profits, or, according to Anson, he bought the shares outright with cash. Either way, he accumulated 5% of the team and would ultimately, through a recharter of the team later on, accumulate a total of 13% of the team. And then in 1890, he bought 5% of the New York Giants. So I'm trying to imagine today Max Scherzer owning 13% of the Mets, and then to try and keep the A's in Oakland buying 5% of that team as well. So it doesn't happen very often anymore that a player owns not just part of his team, but part of another team as well. So in 1890, he really built his legacy in two ways. First of all, as an owner of the team, it was never really expected that he was going to jump to the Brotherhood League. But also, he was declared the man who saved the National League. So during the Brotherhood War, Spalding was working behind the scenes, pulling every legal trick and every bit of chicanery he could to try and screw over the Brotherhood League. And Anson was up front. He was kind of the foghorn. He was the one who was saying things like, I tried to dissuade my players from being foolish, and they betrayed their old employers, and our old players won't be missed at all. And besides, they're all over the hill anyway. So it's no wonder that when the players came back, they all hated him. In fact, almost none of the players who left the White Stockings would come back and play for them again simply because they couldn't stand Cap Anson. Now, the seeds of discord between Anson and the Chicago White Stockings actually started the year that Spalding retires from management. He moves into the front office, becomes the secretary of the team, and instead of naming Anson the manager, which Anson expected, he named Bob Ferguson the manager. Now, Spalding's move to the front office was what Anson saw as his eventual move to the front office. And he admits this in many different ways in many different places, that he saw Spalding as kind of his mentor, and he was the one who was going to be following him. So in 1891, then, when Spalding resigns the club presidency, which he took over after Hulbert died in 1882, Anson fully expected to be named as club president when he resigned. Instead, James Hart is named as club president. And in writing, Spalding told Anson that this was just a temporary measure and that he was just a figurehead and wouldn't really have any control. Publicly, Spalding said that Hart was a man thoroughly and well qualified for the job, which he actually was, as it's going to turn out. But what was unbeknownst to Anson at the time is that while this was going on, both Hart and Spalding were also talking about rechartering the team. In fact, they took the old team and they basically turned it into a real estate holding company, and they rechartered the franchise of the White Stockings and turned it over to the control of James Hart. So while he's telling Anson that Hart's nothing more than a figurehead, the next year, Hart becomes the primary owner of the team. Now, Spalding still owns most of the stock, but at the time the agreement was written up, Hart will buy the stock from Spalding a little bit of time over several years. So Spalding and Anson both retain stock in the team, but Hart is not just the figurehead, he's clearly running the entire team. So this really rankles Anson, and finally in 1898, in order to try and appease Anson, Spalding offers him an opportunity to buy the club. He said, Hart's got a contract to buy out the rest of my stock, but I will give you 60 days to buy the entire team. And he priced the team at $150 a share. Knowing full well that Anson didn't have the money and would never be able to get the money. Now, to suggest what that was really going on, the team was finally sold in 1905, and when it was sold in 1905, Spalding sold the rest of his shares. Well, actually, it sold the shares to Hart by then. All those shares were sold for $105, not anywhere near the $150. And in fact, Anson's shares were only got $76 per share when he sold his shares to Hart the year before that. While Hart was president, which was an excellent move, actually, by the way, he had previously owned minor league baseball teams. He'd managed major league baseball teams. He'd served as the secretary of the traveling squad that went around the world for Spalding. And then after Spalding returned to the United States, he tried to set up a professional baseball league in England, and he left Hart behind in England to be the president of that league. And Hart worked for about a year to get that going and just couldn't get the finances going, and instead he came back and took over the White Stockings. So in 1892, he heads the new White Stockings Corporation. Spalding heads the other corporation, which now just owns a bunch of real estate, which they eventually build a new ballpark on, which they lease to the White Stockings, etc. Hart and Anson never got along. So things only go from bad to worse for Anson here, because not only didn't he become president, but now he's under the employ of a person who, unbeknownst to him, when he bought the new team, when the charter was redone, so was Anson's contract. 1 year was lopped off the contract, and according to Anson, he was never aware that this was going to happen. So he frequently clashes, the two of them frequently clash with one another, and the team begins to go downhill. As you saw earlier, the 1880s were glorious years for the White Stockings and Anson. The 1890s, not so much. They're not good for Anson on the field, and they're not good for Anson off the field in his attempts. So his final six seasons, four of them were losing records. He had 5 second division finishes. In 1897, they finish in ninth place, and Anson is clearly an over-the-hill player by this time. He's got one more year left on his contract, and he goes to Hart to try and negotiate buying some more stock in the team so that he can take over from him. Instead, Hart informs him that his contract has expired, and he will not be coming back the next year. Now, at this time, most of the stock was still owned by Spalding, so it's unlikely that Spalding did not approve of this move, because as the majority owner, even in the background, it just wasn't going to happen without Spalding doing this. And that's exactly what Anson believed too. So when he loses the position here, when he's no longer going to be manager, he's clearly not going to be the owner, then he and Spalding and Hart start to declare a war with one another in the newspaper over who said what and what was really going on. As part of that, Anson accused Spalding of double dealing by not giving him a realistic chance to buy the team, by leading him on, promising he would be president when he wasn't. Spalding and Hart fire back and say, let's take a look at what the books actually say here. Anson's contract called for his salary plus a 10% of the net profits. Now here's a stunner that Major League owners never say anymore, but the owners claim they didn't make any money on the team. They said there were no profits on which we could pay out Cap Anson, and yet we continued to do it. They pointed out that he was paid double his salary every year, even though the team actually didn't make any profits. And they said all the stock that he owned was actually gifted to him by the team with the understanding that he would pay back out of his share of the profits, which, since they never made the profits, he had actually never paid for. And in fact, he still owed several thousand dollars to the team. Well, there are several nice newspaper articles going back and forth where he said, she said, and it's not clear from examining the books exactly who is telling the truth here, but what is clear is that Cap Anson was now through with the Chicago White Stockings, and he's going to move on to what is going to be a sad chapter in the rest of his life. So after he leaves the White Stockings, he takes over as manager of the New York Giants and is fired after 22 games. In 1898, he rebuffed Spalding's offer to a testimonial dinner, which was to give raise $50,000 to give to Cap Anson. He said that he was in no need of charity and he wasn't through yet, but thank you very much for the sentiments. He then attempted to acquire a Western League franchise. That didn't work out. He was then named president of the American Association, and not the original American Association, but one that was going to try and start up as an American League, and it never got off the ground. In 1899, he borrowed some money and built a bowling and billiards parlor and threw himself into bowling and became quite an accomplished bowler and the president of the American Bowling Congress and really very famous in the bowling circles. And the bowling and billiards parlor would do well some years and not so well other years, so it lost as much money as it made, so it wasn't really helping. He also started a semi-pro team called Anson's Colts and a semi-pro football team, also called Anson's Colts. They lost more money than they ever made. Part of his problem was he decided to build his own stadium, which cost him a lot of money. He mortgaged his home, and the team failed. In 1904, he attempted to buy the Washington Senators, but was politely told by Ben Johnson that they had a different buyer who had better business experience. He owned stock in the ball club up until 1905 when he sold it. Or he sold it in 1906, I think. But it never paid dividends during that time. Remember, the team never made money. In 1905, he was elected to the city clerk's position, and in 1906 suffered the humiliation of a series of opinion pieces by the Chicago Tribune pointing out that you should actually show up at the office along with your workers and do work if you're elected to office. So apparently the $5,000 annual salary wasn't enough. And he also had complained in an opinion piece that the kickbacks that were supposed to go to him for selling bonds, city bonds, were all going to somebody else instead. So he proved not to be a really adept politician. In 1909, he put forth his name for the NL presidency, and he was backed by Charles Murphy, who by this time owned the team. He obviously did not become NL president. In 1910, he declares bankruptcy. The National League at that time offered him a pension. They said, for all you've done for baseball, you deserve a pension. And again, he refused. He said, I don't take charity, and I'm not a lost cause yet. He also campaigned that year for the manager job for the Phillies. Did not get that. In 1920, he put forward an attempt to become commissioner of baseball. He did not get any serious votes for that. Earlier in his career, he had actually started what a lot of players did. He joined the vaudeville circuit. And he couldn't sing, he couldn't dance, he couldn't tell jokes, but he would go up with the baseball bat and hit paper mache baseballs that the crowd threw to him, and he'd tell some baseball stories. And he resurrected that career after his wife died in 1915 and he started to need some money. And then in 1920, when he was destitute again, he and his daughter started working on some vaudeville stuff. And they mostly played on the second run circuits in small towns, but towards the end he actually got on the Keith circuit, which was a big one, played in Chicago, and he did have some good audiences and some good reviews, but he never really made any money. Basically, the money he made paid for the traveling. So the end of a sad after career comes in 1922. He died on April 15th, 1922, absolutely penniless. The National League paid his hospital bills, they paid for his funeral, they paid for his burial. They reinterred his wife, who was buried in Philadelphia, and moved her to Chicago, and they erected the monument you see here. And in the end, he was eulogized by Commissioner Landis, who oversaw his first bankruptcy trial. We should pattern our lives after this man, whose steadiness in crises can be compared only with the pyramids or with Gibraltar. That's the end of Cap Anson. Oh, and as a quick aside, the testimonial dinner was scheduled to be held right here at the Palmer House.
Anson was one of the prime movers in segregating baseball, excluding African Americans. In your research, was there any indication whether he was lauded for that or vilified, or any reaction to the genre of baseball stars?
Well, Anson wasn't much more of a racist than anyone else in the 1890s, but what's interesting, when he had a semi-pro team, the Anson's Colts, on numerous occasions he played the Leland Giants. So, you know, what he said in principle when it came to the box office would be a very different thing. And he played the Leland Giants because they were very popular and he could get a good crowd. He wouldn't play against black players in the 1890s because he didn't have to and it didn't make any difference for him. But I wouldn't characterize him as any better or any worse than most other people at the time.
Yeah, just regarding the team nickname, I've done a lot of research in that area, and from what I remember, in 1890, the Players League team was the White Stockings, and the National League team was called Anson's Colts. And they pretty much kept that Colts name down until Anson left. But I noticed you were referring to him as the White Stockings, and you even talked about the corporation being called the White Stocking Corporation. Was that actually what it was called?
That's what the name of the corporation was the White Stockings. Now, so the White Stockings actually did call themselves that as a corporation, but for the most part, nicknames were bestowed by, you know, sports writers.
Yeah.
So yeah, once most of the veterans left and Anson recruited a whole bunch of young guys, they started calling them Anson's Colts or Anson's Babies, or even occasionally they'd call them the Cubs. And that persisted throughout the 1890s because, well, Anson would argue that Hart was cheap and wouldn't let him buy any good players, so he had to keep signing young players. And Hart fired back that no good players would play for Anson anymore and he could only get young players. So, but they were very young and they were called that a lot during the 1890s.
And then even that picture you showed of the team, they clearly weren't wearing white stockings.
Right. In fact, they wore black stockings for a while there, so. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
There's going to be a committee meeting in this room at 4:15, nothing until then, but will be a committee meeting in this room at 4:15 for the Baseball Records Committee.